This is Drive, and I'm Jim Farley. My guest today's personal impact on the global car industry in the city of Detroit would be hard to measure. Bill Ford is only the fourth Ford family member to lead the car company, which was founded 120 years ago by his great-grandfather, Henry Ford. For the past 25 years, he's led Ford with vision, values, and a deep connection to our employees. A few years ago, Bill drove by Detroit's long-abandoned train station, which had become a symbol of the fall of Detroit. And Bill said to himself, I'm going to do something about that. And then he got to work and he rallied our entire city behind him. This summer, Michigan Central Station will open its doors once again after 30 long years. Fully restored, it's the jewel of Detroit and it's a hub for mobility innovation. Please welcome Bill Ford, who also happens to be my boss. You know, one of the things that struck me a lot was interviewing for this role I'm in and how you saw that, because you had been in my shoes, you know, in this role. How does a CEO hiring process work in your eyes from your experience?
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember I always knew you were going to be a fantastic CEO, but I remember the things that I told you then that probably at the time seemed either unimportant or not terribly relevant. I said, there will be three things about this role that you will find that maybe will surprise you. The first won't surprise you because you've heard it, but it's lonely. There aren't many people you can talk to. And at the end of the day, it all is on your shoulders and everybody else can give you advice. But in the end, it's you and you have to make that call. And you can't have a bad day around your team. So it's not like you can moan and groan about how difficult things are. Two, I said the business problems will be the easy ones. You'll look at all the data, you'll make your best judgment, and you'll go forward.
Yes.
But it'll be the people problems that will really drive you crazy and keep you up at night. Mm-hmm. And then finally, knowing you as I did through the years, I mean, you are a very definite person. And yes, no, black, white, stop, go. But I said, in this job, there are lots of shades of gray, and that will also drive you crazy because it won't be 100% zero when you make a decision. And I remember telling you all that, and I remember you thinking, he probably either doesn't really believe it or doesn't really know what I'm talking about. But I suspect today you get all of that.
I do. You nailed it. Absolutely. And one of the things that is a pride point for everyone at Ford is your connection with the environment. Where did that come from? Like yeah. It's always been a big part of your life.
Well, it has. And I think it's because growing up, I loved the outdoors. And as soon as I got my driver's license, I blasted up to Northern Michigan on the weekends and we'd go into the streams there and fish. And I loved doing that. And then in the fall, I would do the same thing. I'd go bird hunting in the woods of Michigan. And then it occurred to me over the years, not just in Michigan, but other places I like to go, that I'd return and they'd been degraded somehow. Either there was a strip mall where there never used to be one, or some water that I used to love had been polluted. And that really bothered me. And I remember thinking to myself, why isn't somebody doing something about this? And then I got into college and I started reading environmental books. There was a book by Rachel Carson called Silent Spring that I read that was really struck a chord with me. And I just remember it all kind of resonated with me. And then I joined Ford and I was so struck that by not only how nobody cared, but actually how anti they were. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget when I joined the board, I was pulled aside and told, you must stop associating with any known or suspected environmentalists.
Oh,
yes. And I thought to myself, absolutely no. Somebody has to build a bridge between the two communities. But it was interesting because when I tried, I don't know who had freaked out more, the Ford people or the environmentalists, because the Ford people thought I was crazy and the environmentalists thought I was a wolf in sheep's clothing. And so for a long time, I had no friends on either side.
And it's changed now so much.
Yeah. I mean, and now it's part of our business and it's great. I mean, for a long time, we were sort of paying attention to it, but as an add-on, it was never part of the core business. Now it's part of every business decision we make. And that's why I don't talk about it as much anymore, because I feel like we're there. I mean, sure, there's always going to be things to work on.
So one of the things that is so motivational for me is your vision, not just for the company, its sustainability, as well as vibrancy from a talent and from an employee standpoint, but also for the city of Detroit. You have a really deep connection. And the Michigan Central Station, which a lot of listeners won't know much about, is such a marquee project in the kind of transformation of Detroit. How did that, could you explain to the listeners a little bit more about that project and why does it resonate with you? And where do you think it's going to bring the city of Detroit?
So I'm old enough to remember the riots that took place in the late 60s here. And I remember flying over the city and it being on literally on fire. And prior to that, everything I did was in the city. My doctor, my dentist, I bought my clothes. Everything we did was in the city. And then after the riots, everything moved to the suburbs and the city was on a 50-year decay. And when I would drive through Detroit in the last 15, 20 years, there was this train station. And that train station was often the emblem. When there were stories written nationally about the decay of Detroit, that was usually the visual that accompanied it.
I remember like Time Magazine had a big cover story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always said to myself, one day, if I can figure out a way, I'm going to help change all that. And so to the listeners, what we've done, and Jim, you've been a big part of this, is we've completely renovated the train station, and this spring we'll be opening it up to the public, and it's going to be so magnificent. And everybody who ever had a memory or a history in Detroit will, I think, absolutely love it. But it's much more than a trip down memory lane. It's also about where we're going to help create the future of transportation. So to me, it's something very exciting because it took our worst eyesore and it's making it beautiful again. It's open to the whole community. So everybody in Michigan will be able to have fun and enjoy it. But also there'll be a lot of forward-leaning projects happening there to help make sure that the Motor City remains a Motor City.
And your family, your Ford family, I think everyone in the U.S. knows the story of the Ford family, but many of them will not have had the luxury of learning about your perspective. Could you tell a little bit about your grandfather and your dad and their connection to Michigan and the industry, as well as what made them tick as people?
Yeah. I mean, so actually, my dad's side, it was Henry Ford. My mother's grandfather was Harvey Firestone. So when my parents got married, it was more like a merger than a marriage, I think. But,
American royalty.
Yeah, exactly. So I really grew up steeped in the history of industry. And my dad had so many stories growing up of Henry Ford and kind of all the mischief that the two of them used to get into together. And my father was quite a character, and I think Henry Ford was too. And so I grew up with all those stories, and I was always fascinated by them. But I remain this way today. Is interesting as the past was, and it really is, I'm much more interested about what happens next.
Yeah.
I was a history major in college. I love history. I read, that's all I do is read history in my spare time. But to me, it's almost to inform what happens next. And so I love my history of the Ford history. I love growing up with it. I love all the stories around it. And I love all the cars and trucks that I've had access to my whole life.
And speaking of that, what's your perspective on the importance of our industry to our country?
Well, I think you only have to go back to a couple of big events. One, World War II, when we were truly the arsenal of democracy. But much more recently, when COVID struck, we were the industry and we were the company to gear up and really go to bat on behalf of our country. And I think if our country ever loses that, it will lose something that it'll never be able to replace. And I would go a step further. I don't think there's a single country in the world since the Industrial Revolution that has been a strong country that didn't have a strong industrial base.
Yes.
And you and I have both seen in our lifetime countries that have lost their industrial base.
UK is a good example.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And when that happens, it's a downward spiral.
One of the pleasures of being in this role is to watch you walk through a plant. Your connection with the employees, I saw it even in a Lions game. Your connection with people is something that is so fundamental. Can you tell us about what happened at the Rouge and that moment in time and how you looked at it as a person?
Yeah, well, so this was back in, I think it was 99 or 2000. I had just taken over as chairman very early. And I saw smoke rising from my window. And then shortly thereafter, somebody came into my office and said, there's been a terrible explosion at the Rouge. So I grabbed my coat, and I'll never forget, our chief lawyer said to me at the time, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to the Rouge. He said, no, you can't. And I said, why not? And he said, well, it could be very dangerous physically. We could have liability issues. And then somebody else said to me, well, don't you realize generals don't go to the front? And I said, well, then bus me to private because I'm out of here. And those are my exact words. And so I went, and it was awful. And a number of employees passed away that day. Others were very, very much hurt. And I remember I spent probably a week without sleeping, going to all the hospitals. And I gave my personal credit card to all the families because there was nothing set up for them. And they needed all kinds of things. They needed food. Some of them needed a place to stay because their husbands had been working remotely and they lived out of town. Others needed to plan funerals. And one of the things that happened out of that was I became very close to a lot of the families under the worst of circumstances. It was a terrible time and probably the worst day of my career, but it weirdly became one of the better times of my career as well.
And that connection with employees will always be there, but you even play hockey with employees at Ford.
I do.
What's that
like? I do.
How do you think that they hesitate checking you?
Well, they did it first, and now they can't wait. But now, listen, I'm slow and old, but they take it easy on the old guy. I really enjoy it because it's a way for me to hang out with groups of employees that I probably wouldn't know otherwise. And I love to play hockey, and that's a lot of fun. And it's like your race car driving. When you're doing it, you can't think of anything else. It's a way to clear your mind. But for me, it's also a great way just to hang out with a group of employees and get to know them away from work. And I love that.
Well, you certainly had a lot of unique experiences. I remember I read somewhere that you knew Walt Disney. What was he like as a person?
Yeah, so my parents had a house at a place called Smoke Tree Ranch in Palm Springs, California. And Walt Disney did too. And everybody would go in the evenings, and it still happens today, to this communal facility where you would eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So every night at dinner, Walt Disney was there. And as a little kid, he used to draw Mickeys and Minnies on our napkins for us.
Oh my God.
And I said to one of my friends the other day, did anybody save those napkins? And of course, nobody did. Nobody can find them, but I'm sure they'd be worth a fortune if we could. And I'll remember the tennis pro there who Walt had hired, I thought had the coolest job in the world because he was the test rider for all the new rides.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I remember I must have driven this poor man crazy because I would follow him around and just ask him, you were the first guy in the Matterhorn? Oh my gosh, what was that like? And have you ever gone off the track and go flying through the air? I mean, I asked this poor guy every question. He was very patient, and if he was still alive, I think I'd give him a medal for putting up with me. But I just thought he had the coolest job in the world. So I became a huge Disney fan. And to this day, I mean, my kids now are all older. They're all grown, which is too bad because they were the reason I'd say we had to go to Disneyland every year.
And you have a lot of hobbies that I know the listeners would be interested in. One of them is fly fishing.
Yep.
Where did that come from? And what gets you excited about fly fishing?
Well, I don't really know where it came from. My mom and dad belonged to this fishing club, which they literally never went to. I think they inherited it from his parents. But I got taken there when I was probably 10 or 11. And just like the man I described at Walt Disney, there was an old caretaker there who took me into the woods and was showing me, he'd say, you see that beech tree and see those marks? That's where a bear climbed to eat. And I thought, wow, that is so cool. And like the other gentleman I just referenced, I must have driven him crazy because I followed him around for 4 days, asking him every possible question about every animal, everything. And then he taught me how to cast a fly. And we actually caught a fish. And I thought, my goodness, this is amazing. So that kind of got me going. And every year for my birthday, I would ask for that to be my birthday present, be a trip up there. And my mother was such a good sport because she didn't fish and she'd go sit on the porch for 4 days and read a book while I was out in the stream literally all day and into the night. And then, as I said earlier, as soon as I got my driver's license, I would just blast up to Northern Michigan and fish. And I've loved it forever. I own a fly rod company.
Oh, what's it called?
It's called Scott Fly Rod. It's in Colorado. And I bought it. Oh, gosh. I bought it when I was working in England in the 80s. And I live vicariously through those guys because they take all the great trips around the world. And
I see.
So, yeah, it's quite different than hockey, but it's the same in that if you're doing it, you can't let your mind wander, because if you do, your fly's in a tree and it always takes you someplace pretty. That's what I love about fly fishing. I remember the gentleman who taught me to fish said there are several phases of fly fishing. The first phase is you just want to catch a fish.
Yes.
Second phase is you want to catch a lot of fish.
Yes.
Third phase is you want to catch a big fish.
Yes.
And finally, you just want to fish. And I think that's so true. I'm at the stage now where I couldn't care less whether I really catch anything. I just want to go out there and be somewhere cool.
I remember seeing you on the podium when we won Le Mans in 2015-16. You've been a racing fan your whole life.
Well, I pale in comparison to you, but you know, my dad drove the pace car several times at Indy, but in 68 I rode with him and I was 11. And I remember getting on the back of AJ Foyt's motorcycle at the Speedway Motel and riding around, and he used to do wheelies with me on it. And my dad thought it was great. I think my mother was not so excited.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all those old guys like Gurney and Foyt, they were just all such characters. And I became a huge fan. And you mentioned Le Mans in 16. I mean, that was such a wonderful event because 50 years prior we had won. And then we left shortly thereafter Le Mans, and the whole Ford versus Ferrari, which now, of course, is a movie.
Yes.
But in 16, there was no Ford versus Ferrari movie. But there were a lot of memories, both on the Ford and Ferrari side, about what that meant. And so it was so awesome to go back with our supercar and in year one win and beat Ferrari.
Well, speaking of winning, how about the Lions? This is pretty special, especially for you and your family.
It's been a long time. It's been too long. And the fans have been fantastic, and they've never given up on the team. And like any fans, they're passionate, and that when you don't do well, they'll let you know it. But, you know, the electricity around this city this year has been really incredible. And, you know, it's been a long time coming. And so these same fans who have been sort of cynical were just waiting for a reason not to be. And now they don't have to be.
And seeing the excitement in your immediate family was amazing. They have a connection with the Lions. It's very fundamental.
Yeah. So my dad bought the team in 64. It's funny. I don't think he ever really meant to own the team. He was a very small minority owner.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And what happened was there was a big proxy fight among all the owners. And apparently they were in two divided camps and they couldn't come together. I don't know what the issue was, but I remember my dad telling me the story. And so the two sides were entrenched. And finally, they both went to my dad and said, look, the only solution is if you buy us all out.
I see.
And so he did.
Were they mostly from Michigan?
Yeah, they were pretty much all from Michigan. As I say, he was one of the minority, but so he bought the team in 64. And we had some good years and a lot of bad years. But through it all, it was a labor of love. And I remember when Ford transferred me to Europe, and it was before there was video, I would call home or call a friend who would put the phone next to the radio so I could listen to every single Lions game. And I did.
No kidding.
Every home and away game, I would listen by telephone. I had some pretty big long-distance phone bills. So it's been a labor of love of ours, and it's wonderful to see it all kind of come to fruition now.
So what does Bill Ford drive every day?
Kind of like Jim Farley, whatever we feel like it, which is one of the great things about this job. Yes. And I think one of the things that you've done so beautifully about this job, because you are a car guy, is there were years where I literally wasn't sure if there was anything I wanted to drive. Mm-hmm. Now I want to switch out all the time, because under your leadership, we have such awesome cars. And whether it's Broncos or Raptors or Mustangs, I mean, you go down the list and it's almost like 31 flavors. I mean, where do I start? Hmm. And that's the great thing about this business is the passion. But we lost that passion at certain points in our past. And part of it wasn't always our fault, because there was such regulatory compliance pressure on us that it was hard to make a really great car or truck. But I think you've decided that those were excuses, not reasons, and we should have great cars and trucks, and we do. So the short answer is I've got a bunch of really cool old vehicles that I own, and I love driving all the new stuff, whether it's our new EVs or whether it's our new off-road vehicles or the latest performance Mustang. They're all awesome.
And there are a few families who've started car companies, none more famous than the Ford family, but a lot of them aren't involved in every day, but your family and you, what is the connection with the company, you think?
Well, it's certainly different for everybody else. Look, I'm only the fourth family member to ever actually be in this job in 120 years. So for me, it's a great sense of responsibility. It's a great sense of pride. It's a great sense of we have to take care of our employees and our communities and all the people who love Ford. But it's also about giving them a path forward. It's about not just having them feel like we are paternalistic and taking care of them, but it's also about giving them excitement, hope, and that their children and their grandchildren will want to work here. And I think that's what you are creating now is the Ford of the future. And it's really tough because on the one hand, you are continuing to build the old Ford and not let it rot and decay, but you're infusing our internal combustion engine with incredibly exciting vehicles. But at the same time, you're taking us down this road to an EV future, which will be very different skill sets needed with our employees, different awareness by our customers. And to do either one is hard, but to do them together has never been tried before. But to me, it's so exciting because when we pull this off, and we will, it's going to create a company like nobody's ever seen before.
And what's your perspective on EVs? They've gotten politicized recently, but you've seen them evolve. I remember seeing one of your first vehicles that you collected was our first hybrid. Ford was there before Toyota, anyone. What's your perspective? How do you think this EV journey is going to play out?
Well, it's always fascinating. In fact, our first EV was a lead acid Ranger pickup truck where the entire bed was filled with batteries, and we got about 50 miles even out of all that. But, you know, I think the politicization is unfortunate, but in some ways it's irrelevant. EVs aren't for everybody, and I think when you look at things like our Super Duty that are internal combustion, they'll be around for a long time. But EVs can do things that ICE vehicles can't do. And, you know, and people, I think, lose sight of that when they get involved in this red state, blue state kind of conversation. They aren't going to be right for everybody. And for those people, we have an amazing lineup where it's not right for them. But increasingly, people are saying, these things are amazing. I can power my home from them. I can power a work site with them. Yeah. The kind of content that can be downloaded into them is incredible. And so I look at it not as a political thing at all, but really a capability thing. And I think we, Ford, have the best of all worlds, and that we are developing world-class EVs while continuing to invest in the most exciting ICE vehicles. Nobody else can offer that. Nobody.
So what was your first company car at Ford?
I remember my first car. My dad in 1975, which is the year I graduated from high school, gave me a Mustang. And this thing, it was very cool. It was painted a green metallic.
Oh my God.
Okay. The problem was it was a show color. It was never meant for production.
Okay.
So one day I decided I was going to take it to Northern Michigan skiing. So I drove up to Northern Michigan. The temperature dropped below zero that night. I walked out the next morning and the paint was literally standing up straight in strips. The whole thing had just disintegrated. The show color disintegrated. So that was my very first car. It was very cool though. It was tan leather interior with green metallic paint, at least for a while. And that was the first car. The first car I ever drove.
Yeah.
So one of the cool things about growing up was my dad brought home pretty much everything.
Yes.
So when I was probably about 8, 9, or 10, I'd get on his lap and we'd drive around our driveway and that was fine. But what he loved to do was if you come down the driveway to my parents' house, in front of the house, it was a circular driveway. So my dad, whenever it would snow, would do donuts in our driveway. And those days they were all rear wheel drive cars.
Right,
so they were
easy,
and the heavier, the better. You could just whip them around. So I remember one day when my dad was eating dinner, I was probably around 10. I thought, that looks like a lot of fun. I guess I'll go do it. So I jumped in his car and I gunned it. Well, I didn't know how to counter steer or anything. Yeah. And I, just as my mother was opening the front door, I pretty much went through the front door. Thankfully, I didn't take her out, but I was grounded.
What did your dad say?
My dad, in front of my mother, had to scold me and say, that was so irresponsible. How dare you, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And the minute my mom was out of earshot, he said, okay, now here's how you do a donut. So from that point on, he and I would have donut contests in the driveway whenever it would snow. So I remember the first front wheel drive car that my dad brought home was a real disappointment because you couldn't do the donuts.
No. A lot harder. Yeah. That's incredible. So your kids are involved in the business now. What's that like for you as a dad?
Well, it's really exciting, but they have to love it. It's interesting. All of my kids said to me at various points, you never really talked to us about working at Ford. And I said, the best advice my father ever gave me was when I was graduating from college. I remember we were playing pool in my parents' basement. And my dad said, what's next? And I said, well, I think I might go work for Ford. And he looked at me and he said, well, don't do it on my account or anybody else's. He said, if your heart isn't in it and if you don't love it, you're not going to be doing the company or yourself any favor. And so I really took that to heart. And I remember saying to my dad, well, how do I know unless I try it? And he said, well, you can try it. But honestly, you can't fake it. And if you don't love it, you won't be good at it. And frankly, neither you nor the company will benefit. And I really took that to my own children to the point where they were kind of at a certain point really bothered the fact that I'd never spoke to them about it because I wanted them to really want to do it. And so Alexandra, as you know, is on our board and she loves it. And my son Will just joined and he loves it. But also too, it's important, I think, one of the rules I've put in for our family, and not just my kids, but all the relatives. And I wasn't very popular when I did this. I said, you must work somewhere else for a minimum of 5 years, and you must have a second degree from a really good school, and it must be a relevant degree. It must either be business, engineering, or law, because you must be as good as everybody you're working with. And if you're not, you're going to know it before anybody else, and your own self-confidence is going to be shot. Mm. So this isn't a family employment agency. If you really want to do it and you're really willing to put the work in, then yeah, give it a shot. And I'd love it if it worked out. It'd be great. But it's not great for me. It's got to be great for you. And so we'll see. It's early days for my kids, but they all took it to heart. Alexandra and Will both worked somewhere for quite a while first. They both got second degrees from top schools. And that's also really to working somewhere else. There are two reasons. One is you grow up somewhere else. You don't have one foot still on the university campus. But the other is if you do well, you get a sense of confidence. And if you're at Ford, you always will wonder, is it because of my last name? Am I really good enough? Or are people just not telling me the truth? If you succeed somewhere else first, you'll have a much better sense of that and also what you really want to do in life. So, yeah, I hope more family members join, but they have to earn it.
And that's something I've heard you say many times, that our industry can be too isolated and too self-absorbed. Do you feel like with all the technology now, we're starting to break out of that, or will that always be a risk?
No, I don't think it was a risk my entire lifetime. I mean, look, the Motor City, that's what it was. And then for most of my career, I was just shocked at the lack of curiosity by our executives towards what was going on around in the world. And in the most negative, I mean, Jim, when you worked at Toyota, you were stealing the march on us, and we didn't even notice. Everybody looks out the window in Dearborn, Michigan, and sees nothing but American cars and thought, wow, life is good.
Yes.
Well, guess what? You drive out to California or parts of New England, and the world didn't look like that. That's at the most basic level. But then with technology and everything else developing, I was terrified that our insularity was going to kill us as a company. And you actually probably certainly more than any other executive have broken us out of that. Part of it is just who you are. By nature, you're very curious and you like to learn and you like to learn new stuff. But part of it was very intentional because you saw the need to break us out of that mindset. And it really has paid off. And I don't know if we'll, I mean, I hope we never go back to that. Yep. But I think once you're out of it, it's hard to go back to it. And the kind of people you've brought in to your management team, a lot of them don't come from our world. And they don't share that insularity or, and thank goodness for that.
Well, I have one question I ask every guest, and I have to ask you, and I've been a little bit worried about asking you, but do you have any advice for me as the head of
Jim,
board?
I've given you all the advice I can give you. And so, no, look, the one thing that I think you do so well that I've seen so many CEOs do badly is you've remained authentic. I think that somebody once told me about this building, which for our listeners who don't know, is it's a glass building. And somebody once said, the higher you get in this building, the windows start turning into mirrors. You start to believe your own greatness, your own press clippings. You're surrounded by people who tell you how wonderful you are and how great you are. And it's so dangerous. And yet it's so seductive because everybody likes to hear good things.
Yeah.
And so I think what you've done, which most people don't do, is you've grounded yourself before this job and you know what's important to you. And I would say this, the saddest thing, maybe, and I don't need to give you this advice, but because you're already doing this, but the saddest thing I've ever seen is an ex-CEO. And why do I say that? Because when the music stops, they often don't have a close family. They've lost their friends along the way. They don't really know who they are or where their place in the world is. And nobody's telling them how great they are anymore, and they're lost. And you're not in danger of that. So I would never give you that advice because you're one of the few who I think has a very strong sense of who you are. You have old friends who have nothing to do with Ford Motor Company. You have a family that you care deeply about, that if Ford all ended tomorrow, you'd still care deeply about them, maybe even more because you'd have more time, but you still make remarkable time. I think that's all that matters, really, is family and old friends, because they're the ones who will tell you. And that's what the other thing is. We all need people that will tell us when we're acting like idiots,
yeah.
Right?
And there are no shortage of people in my life who will tell me what you just said. Yeah,
well, I'm afraid in my life, I give them lots of opportunities.
Same right here. I guess the natural question for me to ask on behalf of all the people listening is legacy. What do you want legacy for you to be? Because you're always looking for what's next for you and your family, but especially for Ford Motor Company.
Well, that's really hard for me to answer because that's a backward-looking question rather than a forward-looking question. To me, a legacy is not something you can plan for. It's a fallout of everything you do, right? And so I guess at the end of when I'm finished with this or something, they kick me out of here, it'll be for others to figure out whether I made a difference or not. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm so interested in tomorrow that the idea of a legacy kind of scares me, actually, because it implies there are no tomorrows.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I don't believe, I have seen CEOs try and plan for the legacy, and you can't do that. A legacy comes from what you've done. Good, bad, indifferent, all the people you've affected positively, negatively, it all adds up to your legacy. And all you can hope for, at least in my case, is that the positive side slightly outweighs the negative side. And if that happens, I'll be very happy.
Well, Bill, I couldn't imagine doing this job without you, the way you lead, your vision for our community, for the company. It's such a privilege. And thank you so much for taking time to share a little window into your life and your experiences.
No, thanks, Jim. And thank you for all you're doing. I mean, you're an amazing CEO, and I believe that. And I'm not just saying that because you're here. And I tell everybody that. And I can't tell you how much I personally just enjoy working with you. You know, I've worked with a lot of executives, and some have been great, some haven't been so great. But on a personal level, I've never enjoyed it so much as doing it with you.
Same. Thank you so much, Bill, for your time.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thank you.
Drive is produced by Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom of Magnificent Noise. Our production staff includes Julia Natt, Eva Walchover, and Kristen Muller, with help from Lori Arpin, Krista Gentile, Max Owen Dunell, Catherine Sanders, Darnell Macon, and Mark Truby. Our host is Jim Farley, and this is Drive.